From KUAZ News in Tucson, I'm Julie Bierwonk, and this is Arizona Spotlight. The 4th Avenue underpass is about to be demolished and rebuilt. Today, a report on how downtown residents will have to find another way to 4th Avenue. Acclaimed documentary filmmaker Ken Burns is getting flack for omitting Hispanics in his new epic World War II documentary. Luis Carrion explores the controversy and how it could affect history's perception of Hispanic contribution to the war, and the story of one local Holocaust survivor living here in Tucson. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. At an estimated cost of $26 million, the iconic 4th Avenue underpass will be demolished and replaced beginning next month. The project will take over a year to complete, forcing residents to use an alternate route between downtown Tucson and 4th Avenue. Tony Paniagua reports.
If you've been using the 4th Avenue underpass to travel to and from downtown Tucson, you'll need to make arrangements for an alternate route. The underpass will be closing for approximately 18 months as part of an improvement project by the city. Jim Glock is the director of the Tucson Department of Transportation. He's one of many bicyclists, pedestrians, and motorists who pass through this area frequently.
The need to reconstruct this underpass actually lies with the last mile of the Braz Aviation Parkway that we now characterize as Downtown Links. Someday we do want to extend a roadway over the top of this underpass to then follow the north side of the tracks up to 7th Avenue, connecting to 6th Street, and then heading west to the frontage roads. A new underpass is needed to withstand the roadway loading, as well as accommodate the slightly wider width that we have there.
The closure will affect people on both sides of the railroad tracks, including the neighborhood's eclectic and independent stores.
We'll still be here. We'll be open for business as usual.
John Sedwick has been the executive director of the 4th Avenue Merchants Association for 9 years. He says the underpass improvement or reconstruction has been discussed for at least that long.
Well, we're really excited to have the underpass finally under construction. It's gone through many iterations and stops and starts, and finally, it's actually going to be cast in concrete, so to speak.
Bunny Uriarte has been using this access road for about 4 years, ever since she moved to Tucson to attend the University of Arizona.
I like going downtown, and then it's so convenient to be able to walk straight to 4th Avenue. That's what I did today. And it's just a really nice passageway that I think is really unique and special for Tucson.
What do you think it's going to do to you when it closes down for about more than a year?
Wow, I think that's going to be really difficult for me because I'm so used to going back and forth from downtown to 4th Avenue. I don't know exactly what passageways are going to be open now, so I think I'm just going to have to take a different route.
Ben Reiston also moved here about 4 years ago when he retired. He rides his bike in this area almost every day and says improvements are necessary.
I think it's been a long time coming. The whole street system in this town is archaic. The whole thing needs to turn around. I'm sorry, but it does. And I wouldn't even dare come through one of these things at night. Not at all. But there's a way around it.
But even though this closure may only cause an inconvenience, it's about to get worse. Additional construction is in the works, including I-10 and a road to link it to the aviation highway.
Pending after this, we've got the downtown links that will actually go over the underpass and route the traffic from the Braz Aviation Parkway onto 6th Street and ultimately down to the freeway. We'll have the modern streetcar that's going to be coming down 4th Avenue from the Med Center and going over to Rio Nuevo through downtown.
Still, proponents say the end result will be worthwhile. This underpass was built in 1916, and it's the oldest reinforced concrete railroad structure in the state. The new version will be able to accommodate more train traffic and vehicles. It should also be safer for bicyclists and pedestrians. John Sedwick says it's even slated to have a small water feature on one side.
Will it keep you from visiting the 4th Avenue area?
Oh, no, definitely not. There's other ways to get around here. And if that way doesn't exist, we'll find a way.
And that's what merchants and the city want to hear, hoping people aren't driven away by the commotion. It's budgeted at about $26 million, one of the largest projects in the history of the city's Department of Transportation.
That's Tony Paniagua reporting. Up next, Luis Carreon has a report on the controversy surrounding documentarian Ken Burns' new film about World War II. This is Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Recently, PBS documentarian Ken Burns has been under fire for failing to include Latinos in his World War II epic, The War. He's agreed to edit the project to include at least two Hispanics. Producer Luis Carreon explores the ongoing discussion surrounding the film and talks to two professors at the University of Arizona about the issue and what it means for Latinos in Southern Arizona.
In Arizona alone, 30,000 signed up or were drafted. Nearly 2,000 never returned.
For those of us who have watched the locally produced World War II documentary, Tucson Remembers the War Years, it's clear that the war effort depended on the contributions of an ethnically diverse group of men and women.
Spanish, so she naturally gravitated to this.
This film, produced by KUAT, provides insight into the role that our community had in this historic event. Now that the pool of surviving World War II veterans is diminishing, there is a rush to document the many narratives of this historical event in books, memoirs, and films. And there is perhaps no more anxiously anticipated account of the Great War of this generation than the latest Ken Burns project, The War.
There's a lot of frustration, a lot of dismay, and I hope that PBS finds a solution other than a kind of last-minute add-on to this series, which is really not, to my way of seeing it, acceptable.
Ken Burns, who recently extended his contract with PBS until the year 2022, has been under fire for failing to include Latinos and their contributions in his World War II epic. Academics like Chuck Tatum, Dean of the College of Humanities at the University of Arizona, see this act as emblematic of a historical trend that has minimized the contributions of an entire population.
To say the least, one of the facts that's not included in high school and college, even college texts, history texts, is that Mexican Americans were the most highly decorated group. Coming out of the Second World War, both in the European theaters and the Pacific theaters. Many of them joined to prove, as if they needed to the dominant elites, that they were patriotic. And to sacrifice one's life or to put one's life at risk in order to prove one's patriotism, in order to gain full rights as citizens, I think is a comment in itself of how far or how what few steps have been taken since 1940 through today.
The issues raised in this ongoing discussion reveal the struggles that Chicano and Mexican American academics are faced with in the efforts to articulate a history that has been minimized and ignored in official accounts. Up to 750,000 Mexican American men served in World War II. And now, an important historical narrative of our time, the film by Ken Burns, has brought to light the need for a population to reappropriate the voice of historical accounts.
That narrative that Mexican Americans weren't contributors and did not fight in World War II, I mean, I think it's a disservice for the general population, because they did. And we have to highlight that role, because here is a opportunity to highlight Mexican Americans fighting and engaging in this war to protect this nation. And that's an important representation for everybody to see, but especially for young people to see. We're part of the fabric of this nation. And this Ken Burns documentary is an example of where we're wiped out or invisibilized. Invisibilized is not a word, but we are being invisibilized from these contributions that we've made.
For Lidia Otero, a historian conducting work at the Mexican-American Studies and Research Center at the U of A, and herself a daughter of a World War II veteran, Ken Burns' project represents a historical document that will shape the perception of many regarding World War II.
I think that the high dropout rate, for example, here in Tucson of Mexican-American and Mexican youth is based on low self-esteem, of feeling like they don't belong. And I think that has to do with how they feel about their place, their community, and their larger community of maybe the city and their larger community of the nation. They have to feel like they belong. And history is very powerful in that way, because history outlines who belongs and who doesn't belong. And I think a lot of young people there don't see a future because they feel like they don't belong. And I think that history has the power to perhaps change those things, to say, look, we were vital, we were important in building Tucson, we were important in building of this nation, and we were important in defending this nation when our nation needed us to volunteer. The narrative is also that most Mexicanos were drafted, when of course most of them volunteered. When this nation needed people to fight for this nation, they certainly stepped up. They're doing it now, and they've done it in the past.
Burns has now agreed to edit the project to include at least two Hispanics before its September public TV premiere, but the discussion will more than likely continue as to who should control the historical accounts of a population that continues to grow.
And all we need to do is look at the Lehr report every night, or the nights in which the pictures and a little bit of information is given on the recent deaths, the recent casualties, not the wounded, but the dead from Iraq. And visually, one sees a disproportionate representation in our all-volunteer army of, I think, Latinos and African Americans. So it's happening again.
Luis Carrion reporting. Ken Burns' film The War will premiere in September on public television. The film Tucson Remembers the War Years will air Thursday, June 7th at 8 p.m. on KUAT Channel 6. For more information, go to KUAZ.org. When we continue, Tucson resident Andrew Schott spent a year of his life in a Nazi concentration camp. His story next on Arizona Spotlight on KUAZ. Thank you. The Holocaust was one of the most horrific events of the 20th century. From 1933 to 1945, Nazi Germany and its collaborators murdered approximately 6 million European Jews. Tucson resident Andrew Schott was just a young boy when the German army invaded his country. He spent years in hiding, trying to evade the Nazis. His story isn't much different from that of Anne Frank. As a matter of fact, his family lived across the street from the Franks' place of business. But of course, their stories have different endings. Anne perished, and Andrew survived. This is his story.
I was born in the Netherlands, better known as Holland, maybe. I'm from Amsterdam. I was 9 years old when the Germans invaded Holland. They invaded in May of 1940. The next year, in February, they had what they called the first razzia, where they rounded up Jewish men. And my oldest brother was caught in that. We were given to understand the reason they did it, to provide working force for the farms and the factories in Germany, but he found out later, of course, that wasn't so. My brother ended up at Auschwitz concentration camp. Then things started to happen, you know, as far as the persecution is concerned, and we had to start wearing the yellow stars later. And then my dad was taken away, and he went to Bergen-Belsen. And, you know, we were already banned from all places of entertainment or anything, and then we were placed in a special school of just Jewish kids, and we were not allowed in any place, theaters, ballparks, city parks, swimming pools, you know, all of a sudden. Then they put the stores off limits and just one store in each neighborhood, small stores, we didn't have the supermarkets, were allowed to sell. The Jews were still allowed to eat at that time. And I know the first time that happened in our neighborhood, they had a little store opened up on Wednesday. They closed down at 3, and then at 4:30 they opened up to sell to Jews. My mom took me with her, and there was a sign in the window, and it says, no Jews allowed when humans are on the premises. And that's the way it was from then on. When that happened, I looked at my mom, and the expression on her face is one I'll never forget. To her, you know, to have to wear the star and then to be humiliated like that is just, she was a very proud woman. And the expression on her face when that sign, she never took me to the store again. She didn't want me to see that. And mom and my sister and me, we went to one of the old abandoned canal houses, one of the smaller ones, and up there, my mom and three of her sisters, and we got up there, and my sister says, you know, we can't live here, you know, not as teenagers. And so my sister and I went to Northern Holland. She had been going to school to become a gymnastics teacher up there, and so the two of us went up there, and we lived in the farm fields. And we did real well, and we, you know, we had plenty to eat. We didn't have what we wanted. I know we tried to milk cows, and that didn't work well. But we had grains, we had sugar beets, and you know, stuff like that. Wild bird eggs. Of course, we couldn't cook it; had to eat them raw, and they don't smell too good because they those birds eat on fish. We were in hiding for a little over 2 years, and then we got caught. And we were taken into a gathering camp in Holland, and my sister went to Dachau, and I went to a place called Papenburg. That particular night, it was a Saturday, it had been raining all night, all day, and we depended on workers going in the field. See, in Holland, the farmers, even though we were in dairy country, the farmers grew their own feed for the animals. And so they had people working in the fields, and they had no mechanized equipment, had no cars, no trucks, no tractors or anything like that. It was just pure horsepower. And we'd follow them in the field, and we'd stay around the wagon, and we got away with that all the time. But that night, after being out in the field sitting, hiding behind anything we could find. We were cold and wet, and we found his barn, and we climbed up to the attic, and we found that there was straw on the floor, so we lay down right there. And the following morning, I heard a strange noise, and when I went to the opening in the loft there, I looked out, and I had three German trucks coming at us. So I told my sister, I went back to my sister and told her, let's get out of here. And when I did, I noticed there were about 20 other people sleeping there. After being so careful for 2 years, we had bedded down in a place that had 20 Jews that had been there for about 3 weeks. And if you did that, somebody's going to turn you in because they were paying about $8 per Jew for turning them in. We were separated when we were caught. And so I had no idea where she was at. I saw her at the railroad station, but she went on a different train. And we were packed in there like sardines, you know. And it was a downer because I had no idea what was going to happen to us, whether we were going to go to Auschwitz, which most of the people out of Holland went to Auschwitz. And the rules, of course, I didn't know that at the time. The rules were when you got to Auschwitz and you were under 15, you know, that was automatically death. But I had no idea what was going to happen to me. And I had just about given up, you know, that this was going to be the end. And at that time, I was 13 years old. I celebrated my 14th birthday in a concentration camp. In our camp, dysentery was rampant. Because of the diet we were on, we didn't have much to eat. And every day we had to work. Most of the time, I was put on details that went into the farm fields working for the farmers because the German men were not available. The barracks I was put in had about 65 people in it when I got there. Off of those 65, five, including myself, were alive at the end. We had others come in to replace those that died, and a lot of those died. The reason I survived, I think, in my opinion, is because, first of all, I was young. I was the youngest man in the barrack. The others were all adults. Another thing is we had spent 2 years walking the fields and eating reasonably well. Others that came in had been in hiding in cellars, attics, and stuff like that, but almost nothing to eat. So they were half dead when they got there. People would think, since I was the only teenager in the barracks, that they would kind of embrace me. It didn't happen because they knew if any of the guards wanted to kill me or beat me up or whatever they wanted to do, there was nothing they could do about it. So they did not get close to each other because they couldn't help each other. There were some things, you know, you could do, like, you know, in our barracks, they burned wood to make charcoal and ate it, hoping that that would combat the dysentery. I don't know whether it worked or not, but the guys I was around in the camp was almost like zombies. And I stayed there until the end. We were liberated by the British, and we were taken to a school building in the nearest town. And there I spent about 10 days. Then they built me up a little bit. They sent me back to Amsterdam. And I found my mom alive. And then later on, my sister came from, she was in bad shape. She came by ambulance, but she made it. And then we came to the United States in 1950. We put in for migration after we found out that, you know, nobody else was coming to home. My mom decided it was time for us to start a new life somewhere else. And we put in for the United States, Canada, New Zealand, Australia, South Africa, and we got to the United States, and I came here in January of 1950. And within a year, I was drafted in the Army. They were going to send me to Germany, and I talked to the commander, and he sent me to see a psychiatrist or a psychologist. I don't remember what it was. And he went to the Army, and he said, I don't think you want to send this guy to Germany with a loaded gun. So they sent me to Korea instead. Biggest help I had was from a psychologist. He told me, he said, if you're going to let this ruin the rest of your life, then he won. He's destroyed you. She said, don't let some fanatic determine how you're going to live the rest of your life and how you're going to feel. So my wife and I went on vacation to Denmark. We took the train from Holland. We flew into Holland. We took the train through Germany. And there I talked to the conductor of the train and a couple other people, and I had no problem. I had no feelings of hate. And but I think that psychologist really got to me when she told me that, you know, don't let him determine how you're going to live the rest of your life.
Andrew Schott lives here in Tucson. For years, he would go to schools and speak with area children about his experience. We talked with him in commemoration of Holocaust Remembrance Day in April. And now here's Mark McLemore with the Arizona Spotlight Arts Calendar.
This weekend, if you so desire, you've got a chance to take in three totally different musical styles from three different nations. Tonight, the African Children's Choir will sing at 7 p.m. at the Tankaverde Lutheran Church. That's at 8625 East Tankaverde. You can get information at africanchildrenschoir.com. Tomorrow night, the Giotto Monks present their Tantic Choir performance at Crowder Hall. This event has been moved from Centennial Hall to Crowder Hall. It is tomorrow night at 7 p.m. and uapresents.org has information. This Sunday is Domingo Flamenco at Casa Vicente at 375 South Stone. There are workshops from noon until 4 and dinner and performance starting at 6. Information about Domingo Flamenco at 884-5253. On stage, the Top Hat Theater Club presents The Jester, The Moon, and The Dog, a play for children of all ages. It's tomorrow afternoon at 3 p.m. Their performance space is at Fort Lowell and Country Club. The Live Theater Workshop has several things going on this weekend. Their production of Bell, Book, and Candle continues, and the last performance of The Incredibly Fantastic Expedition of Edie Delectable and the Lava Moosh Pot is at 1 p.m. this Sunday afternoon. Continuing their celebration of films shot in Tucson next week, the Cinema La Placida will show the 80s teen comedy Can't Buy Me Love. That's Thursday evening at sundown at Cinema La Placida. For Arizona Spotlight, this is Mark McLemore.
Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. A portion of the music heard on today's program was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of Arizona Spotlight programs are available online at kuaz.org. Podcasts are also available. I'm Julie Burak.